Thank you. Hello, good evening, and above all, thank you for coming. I came up with the title of this talk before I did the talk, which is always a mistake, and so it's fairly headphone-centric, but I really want it to be a kind of irreverent dodgem ride through spatial psychoacoustics. I've spent many years researching this field, so there are some particularly interesting curiosities about it and how to fool the human auditory system, if that's the kind of thing that interests you. And as this talk develops, it'll become clear why it might well interest you or people in audio in general. As it's a kind of headphone or binaural-centric talk, the audio example is going to be fairly simplistic. It's difficult to distribute a headphone feed to everybody in the audience, so I didn't attempt to. But coming up later, there'll be a web address of a little thing that you can listen to, for which I did the processing, a little voiceover thing that Focusrite put together where there are some processing examples. And it takes you through what we had to do to make a particular simulation for a commercial product, which I can't really talk about tonight. But anyway, that's the background. Also, there'll be my email address at the end, so instead of waving placards going citation needed if there's something you don't agree with, if you want to email me afterwards or just email me to say thank you or I hated your lecture, then please feel free to, because I do like getting correspondence and I'll try and answer it. Here we go. Today I'm going to talk about, well, really three aspects of what it takes to make a realistic spatial illusion. The first thing is steering sound around the head, so actually panning it in three dimensions. How do we determine direction? Because that's the first thing to ascertain. Then what can we control? What of the aspects that affect people's perceived direction can we actually manipulate? Then common pitfalls to avoid if you find yourself doing this kind of thing. Then putting sound in a room, so adding early reflections, adding reverberation. I'll talk quite a lot about that, actually. That's where it gets fun. And simulating loudspeakers. Now, this is because a real sound source is, of course, fairly complex in its directivity and the way it excites the sound field, and that has a huge bearing on the way it's perceived, both if you're simulating it and if you're playing an actual instrument, which is why if someone's playing a trumpet or you're listening to a loudspeaker reproducing a trumpet, you can immediately tell the difference if you're blindfolded and in the next street. There are different aspects of directivity and room excitation. And so I'll talk about loudspeakers particularly because, firstly, that was the area that interested Focusrite, and secondly, it's a good thing to talk about because we're all audio engineers and loudspeakers are things that we're fairly familiar with. And at the end, the future of headphone listening and why it's interesting as a subject. Conveying space in recordings as well. When I originally did this talk, it was to a lot of undergraduates from the University of Plymouth. This is an extension of that talk for just a slightly different audience, but I wanted to put some tips in for recording engineers about what to do with the spatial aspects of their own recordings, and that's really an amalgamation of the findings of this talk. So moving on, because there's a lot to get to. I hope this will be fun. Steering sound around the head. How do we determine a sound's direction and distance? Well, I've put five things down here in order of importance. So the most important thing is at the top, and that is we can see it. Absolutely nothing to do with audio. This is the most frustrating thing. You can play somebody any auditory scene you like. You can do what you like with the audio signal. But if they're listening to Jonathan Dimbleby sounding all crackly, it's going to be coming out of the radio in front of them pretty much no matter what you do. You can block up an ear. You can reverse left and right. But the sound people expect to come from the thing they expect it to come from. Humans in general are massive correlators. We assimilate an awful lot of information and we think all the time, what is this like? What is this like? And that's why the visual sense being the strongest one overrides absolutely anything auditory. So generally either you have to suspend disbelief to some extent when you're listening to headphones or you have to have a visual signal going with it to supplement it. Using knowledge of the likely location of the sound, looking it up in your internal database. Piano comes out of the piano-shaped object in the corner of the room. If Jonathan Dimbleby is sounding muffled, it's either because he's on Radio 4 Long Wave or because he's hiding under your bed, that kind of thing. Then come the auditory cues, the things we can manipulate. Time and level differences between the ears are the things that the human auditory system uses most strongly to work out where sound is coming from. And then guesswork based on the spectral content of the sound. I say guesswork, and it'll become very apparent why it's guesswork to some extent. And finally, moving around and trying to make the sound louder. And you'll know if you're trying to listen to the whereabouts of a 1 kHz tone. We can't hear much. It's got a very, very small bandwidth. Very little detail there, very little for the human hearing mechanism to go on. It's all phase coherent. 1 kilohertz sound is coming out of something in your studio. It can take you a long time to find it, and you have to generally move around and see when it gets louder. The same is true of impulses, of course, because they're so short, you've got nothing to latch onto. So if you hear something clicking away, it takes a very, very long time to locate it, which is why crickets and grasshoppers aren't all eaten. What can we control? Okay, we can control the sound level differences between the ears. Now, psychoacoustically, there's the effect of head shuddering, so the head is an acoustic object. Above about 500 hertz, it becomes a significant thing in the field of acoustics, and sound doesn't diffract around it anymore. It becomes attenuated. So it's louder at one ear because the head produces a shadow, a stronger signal, as the sound reflects off the barrier, and at the further ear, it's weaker. The second mechanism, of course, is inverse pressure law. So if the sound is very close to your head, the differences are quite great between the two ears in terms of level. I've done these little messy spiders are actually contour plots, and I hope they come through. Three different frequencies at 150 hertz, below the frequency where head shuddering really becomes an issue. You've got this almost like a magnet pattern, where it's a dipole because of the inverse pressure law. And as you move out, you expect it to become more and more omnidirectional, and in fact it does, until you're several meters out and there aren't any contours anymore. I don't know if you can read the scale, but this bit here is plus 5 decibels between the two ears at about 25 centimeters from the head. And this is a plus 1 dB contour line. So at 150 hertz, it's very subtle. One particularly interesting thing about this, which I will come back to, is if I stand on a chair and point to this bit, you'll see here that where the contour lines are maximal, where the level difference is is the greatest between the two ears, isn't actually where the ear is positioned. It's a little bit away from the head. Now, this head's width is to scale from the original recording head, so it's actually a few centimetres out. I'll come back to that. And it is one of the pitfalls of doing this kind of stuff, that your head is wider than you think it is. If we move on in frequency, here at 1 kilohertz, things start happening. The diffraction pattern becomes more obvious. This contour line here is 12 decibels interval level difference, so anything along this line is 12 decibels louder in one ear than the other. We can start to make use of these cues. And here at 8.6 kilohertz, well, we've got 25 dB contour line, so the cues there are very, very strong. This is useful because the other thing that we can control is the time difference between the ears. Now, above 3 kilohertz, we can't hear all interval time differences directly. That's why the level differences are so important at high frequencies. The way that the human hearing mechanism works, the way that the inner hair cells work in the brain, we hear time differences because there's a kind of phase locking to the fine structure of the sound wave. Above about 3 kilohertz, the neurons just can't fire quickly enough to convey that. And there's a kind of bimodal thing where instead of firing at a certain point in the phase, it becomes a lot more stochastic, and it fires a little bit if the sound's quiet and a lot if the sound's loud. So we cannot hear interval time differences directly above 3 kilohertz. Brain's not quick enough to do the phase locking stuff. How sensitive are we to time differences? Well, this is quite surprising, and it does depend on who you ask. I've got here a graph of measured interval time difference against angle, and as you can see, the peak of it is about 615 microseconds, meaning you're very sensitive to the interval time differences, really. These cues are very subtle. Now, it depends who you read as to how sensitive we are. Jens Blauert says we can hear a 10-microsecond difference. It's half a sampling period at 48 kilohertz. It's a really minute difference in time of arrival between two ears. That's equivalent to about 1 degree in space, moving 1 degree left or 1 degree right. But the research he quotes is actually from trained anti-aircraft gunners who were listening for aircraft all day and really got quite sensitive to these time differences. I was chatting to a chap from Harman Audio at the last AES convention. They conducted their own research with plebs, or naive listeners, and he said that 10 degrees was about right for a realistic simulation. Now, 10 degrees is still in the order of about 50 microseconds, so even untrained listeners are very sensitive to interval time differences. This sensitivity is such that it's taken about 50 or 60 years of research to work out what's actually going on the neural level, and it's frighteningly complicated. head-related transfer functions. Now, this is the third thing that we can control. We have time differences and we have level differences. That's great. But what happens is we end up localizing sound to a cone in space because there's a conical locus around you where the time and level differences are pretty much the same. So, for example, if I gesticulate with an empty glass, which is asking for trouble, the sound is 45 degrees to the left of me here. Time and level differences are about the same as if it's 45 degrees above me or 45 degrees below me. But I have to localize the sound somehow and resolve that ambiguity. So there are spectral differences. And these are caused by reflections off the torso and reflections off the folds of the ear. And they're called head-related transfer functions. So, as I've said, it allows us to resolve those ambiguities. We can tell the difference between front and back and up and down. But there's a caveat. They must be used with care, which is audio engineer's code for they're a bit crap, really. And I'll show you why. Now, this is one of the most awful graphs I've ever drawn. I'm a bit ashamed of it. The reason why I'm showing it to you is it does show you some of the head-related transfer functions and a kind of idea of the extent of them. This is 0 degrees, so it's in front of the head. That's 45, so it's elevated. And you can see I've rather clumsily stacked them one on top of the other so that they're unfolded slightly, and you can kind of get an indication about how the spectrum changes. Now, two things you'll see from this. The first is that the maximum extent of head-related transfer functions is about plus or minus 5 decibels. Now, if you're playing with filters, you'll know that's not particularly extreme. The differences really are quite subtle, and they can be attributed to other things. So if you're listening to a particular instrument or a particular voice, the spectral cues of that will probably dominate compared with the spectral cues of the head-related transfer function. So a lot of guesswork is involved. For this reason, there's an obsession about using own-ear transfer functions and blocking people's ear canals up and sticking microphones in front of their ears and actually measuring their own ear responses and playing them back to them. It does make things better than using a generalized model from a commercially available recording head, but head-related transfer functions are a fairly weak cue because of this. Now, as I say, this is a fairly crappy drawing because it doesn't really tell you what's going on. What I have done in the next slide is a much, much better graph. What I've done is I've unfolded these into an actual space map, and I'll show you, it's quite clear. But if you look at this ripple here between 2 and 4 kilohertz, probably caused by the torso and the cone filtering going on there, you'll be able to see that much more clearly here. Hurrah! It's actually spatial. So here are the ripples. This is high, this is low, white's high, black's low. And you get a kind of impression what's going on. The 7 kilohertz phenomenon is one that you'll read about in a lot of literature. Basically, 7 kilohertz is kind of the cue that controls elevation and tells us how high things are. It gets about 45 degrees. It reaches a maximum of about 5 dBs high. Generally trails off towards the back of the head. And you can see at the front, there's quite a lot of high-frequency stuff. At the back, the folds of the ears cause it to be a lot lower down. And I say a lot, it's really about 5 decibels. To illustrate, I'm going to play you a couple of sound files. Now, the first one is a drum loop that's unprocessed, just so you get an idea of what it sounds like without applying the HRTFs. The second one is 4 of these together. And I've convolved gradually each of these head-related transfer functions. So as I play it, the filter responses sweep round the head. And I want you to determine as you listen to it whether or not it's actually interesting or particularly salient. Now, this isn't the most optimal demo, but it will give you an idea. I'll play them both, I'll segue them both together so you get a much better impression. And as a second audio file plays, I'll try and sweep along to show you where it is on the playlist, which means getting to the chair quite quickly. I love big screens. Unprocessed. Unprocessed. Not the most optimal environment, but I think you'll agree they're not particularly convincing. So, moving on. Spectral cues aren't particularly good. What if we track the head and dynamically update the headphone feed to maintain a constant illusion? Now, we're into the virtual reality territory. I don't think I've produced anything else underneath this slide. I think this is just a teaser. I've played around with this before, and there are a few commercially available examples. This is really the vanguard of the technology available, because obviously if you're dynamically adjusting audio based on head-tracked data, it needs quite a lot of DSP to commute and convolve all of the head-related transfer functions in real time, and you've also got to put room reflections in, which we'll come into later. The second problem is head-tracking equipment is still either very, very slow and not very good, or extraordinarily expensive. So the Polymus Fast Track, which a lot of academic researchers have used for this kind of stuff, is a $4,000 system, and all it will do is tell you the position of your head. Webcam technology, where you just point a webcam at somebody, and there's a Pentium 4 chucking away somewhere in the background that's working out where the main salient features of the face are and turning that into angles. That's reaching maturity now, but still uses an abysmal amount of processing time, and of course you need a USB webcam, which is great if you've got a computer. If you're doing a dedicated piece of hardware, it's a right pain. So this is still emerging technology. You can download this, you can download and you can buy things that already do this to some extent, but they're, as I say, eye-wateringly expensive, so we're still kind of at the vanguard, despite the fact that people have been experimenting with this for about 10 years. But it's great. This is the important thing. If you head track sound, people naturally move their heads around when they're looking to locate something. If an auditory object is in front of you, about here, and you move your head clockwise, it goes towards the center. If it's behind you and you move your head anti-clockwise, it moves towards your ear. So immediately the ambiguity is resolved. Front-back discrimination is great. If it's above you, then you turn your head and the movement is actually slower because it's sine 45 degrees above you. And so the time differences move more slowly. And it does resolve pretty much every ambiguity that you can think of. If I move back a bit, there's one thing I forgot to say about spectral cues being rubbish. That is, if you supplement them with room reverb information, and you have reverberation, they get a lot better because the auditory system has a generic mush with which to compare it. So if the sound has a 7 kilohertz, boost of 7 kilohertz of 5 dB, and the mush generally doesn't change because the diffuse sound is still the same, it makes it a lot easier to hear what's going on. Anyway, pitfall number one, your head is bigger than you think. If you measure a dummy head or the tyrannically median 50% head that they use as crash test dummies, 15.2 centimeters between the ears now, almost every commercially available dummy head has this separation. It's the tyranny of the average. What happens, though, is if you try and measure acoustically how wide the head is, if you do it by working out what the maximum interval or level difference is or the maximum interval or time difference is when it's at 90 degrees to your head, either dividing it by the speed of sound or working out using the inverse pressure law at low frequencies what the difference is, and go by circuitous means to find out acoustically how big the head is. By time difference, by level difference, is about 21 centimeters, so it's a good couple of inches larger. And by time difference, it's also a good couple of inches larger. Now, this is down to the boundary effect. Loudspeakers have this, as well as microphones, as well as any kind of equipment that you stick in a room. If you're producing or you're recording sound or you're listening to sound, the boundary effectively moves the acoustic source away from where it actually is. John Van Der Kooi expressed this far better than I could. He did a paper at the last AES convention about the low-frequency acoustic center. And if you're interested in the maths behind it, it's got lots of lovely differential equations because he's terribly clever, and it goes through this in detail. But he came to the same conclusion when he was measuring loudspeakers. The acoustic source of a loudspeaker tends to be a good 2 or 3 inches in front of the actual loudspeaker cone. If you measure around that point, the loudspeaker is truly omnidirectional low frequencies, and it means that you don't have to account for a lot of the mess that you often see when you're recording directivity response of a loudspeaker. Very interesting. But for the sake of audio processing, the head's about 21 centimeters wide. Driving your listeners mad, pitfall number two. What happens when you put spatial cues in conflict? Now, there are a number of listening experiments from the 1980s and from the late 1970s when this technology was fairly new. Computers were rather expensive and thin on the ground, and they just couldn't do real-time audio processing. When researchers attempted to find out what was happening in the human auditory system by putting cues into conflict. So they'd start by taking a sound, panning it one way using time differences, then panning it the other way using a level difference, and asking listeners to determine when the sound is central. Well, what happens is listeners don't hear the sound moving back towards the center, except in very rare cases. What they hear is the sound kind of dividing up into a fudge, or two separate sources, or a whole continuum. They try and determine the center of gravity. It actually actually irritates listeners if you ask them to do this, because it's a very difficult test, and it might vary from day to day depending on what they've been doing with their ears the previous night. Also, if you've ever listened to loudspeakers that are anti-phase, you know it's disconcerting. And from other anecdotal evidence, we know that if we throw human spatial cues into conflict, we get trouble. So if your inner ear is telling you something different about your balance from your eyes, you're violently sick. And that's what happens with seasickness. If they project an artificial horizon onto a room on a ship, it reduces the amount of seasickness that people feel, because you're giving them a consistent illusion. We throw cues into conflict for research or for fun, or just because we don't know what we're doing at our peril. Things work for a little while, and then eventually listeners get driven mad, and it's one of the reasons we encounter listening fatigue. Pitfall number three, processing conventional stereo. Now, there's a shortage of dedicated binaural material. There's also a shortage of things that are described in terms of auditory scenes, so not many people go out and record a string quartet by recording each instrument separately into a mono microphone or a stereo microphone and giving you the feed and saying they're over there and allowing you to position things. So generally speaking, we're stuck with conventional loudspeaker stereo. There are a few problems with this. Proper spatial cues aren't generated in loudspeaker listening between 1 and 3 kilohertz. Now, we get away with it because the human auditory system isn't so acute at those frequencies. It's a crossover between time differences and level differences being more salient. And generally, if there are stronger cues at other frequencies, the hearing system tends to ignore what's going on in the middle band. It's generally quite difficult to determine what's happening. If you take a left loudspeaker and a right loudspeaker and sum them at ears in mathematically and work out what's going on, the level and time differences do mess up at those frequencies. Ooh, that's fun. Stereo intended for loudspeakers is a compromise, therefore. And what are the next captions going to be? This is great. I love PowerPoint. Sound will always cluster towards the nearer loudspeaker, which is why we have three channels at the front in cinema. It's a problem. You can't move around an image intended for loudspeaker stereo because it's designed to be listened to at one point in space or somewhere very close to it. If you move towards a right-hand loudspeaker, not only are those sounds louder now, they reach your ears first. And after about a couple of feet, you tend to not realize the left loudspeaker is doing much at all until someone switches it off. Stereo isn't great for a large audience. And it's not really great for binaural processing. So that's the first bit. The second bit is putting sound in a room. This is the... I've been holding this for about 50 minutes. I think I'll drink some. Excuse me. I can stop using it as a prop now. Putting sound in a room where we add a reverberation. Humans are mad for reverberation. We need to hear it to put sounds in context. Bit of early acoustics. I love the history lecture, so I'll give a quick one. Wallace Sabine, I'm sure everybody here is familiar with his work, single-handedly and accidentally invented the whole field of modern room acoustics in 1895 as an undergraduate. Harvard had just opened a lecture theatre and an art gallery, the William Fogg Gallery, had enormous reverberation time. They asked all of the physics professors at Harvard what to do about it. They said, we don't have time, we're too busy doing physics. And eventually the work got palmed off onto an 18-year-old undergraduate, Wallace Sabine. It was nothing but an organ pipe, a stopwatch, and a bundle of horsehair blankets. He pretty much worked out what was going on with room acoustics, how to reduce the reverberation time, and his efforts were ultimately successful. He was quite a fastidious scientist as well. He once repeated a whole day's measurements because he was wearing a different suit that day. He thought that might be affecting what was going on in the room. But he was nothing but an organ pipe, his ears, and a stopwatch to measure reverberation time. It must have taken him months. I'm pretty sure it did. But anyway, he came up with the Sabine formula, which we like. The wonderfully important but also annoyingly overused, very, very simple equation. Reverberation time is proportional to the volume of the room over the total absorptive surface area. Very, very simple formula, very elegant. Not quite right in every room. We have better approximations now. We like mathematicizing things, and the Eyring formula is slightly better. But this still works really well in most rooms. The simplicity of it is its beauty. It also tells you empirically that if you double every dimension in a room, you double the reverberation time. All things being equal, if you double us every dimension, volume increases by a factor of 8 cubed. Surface area increases by a factor of 4 because all of the surface areas of every object changes, so the reverberation time doubles. This tells you the bigger room is more echoey than the smaller room, everything else being equal. And he's right, and I'll come back to that later. Reverberation. We'll start with the sound on sound 101, and we'll take it to pieces, because people talk about reverberation from the point of view of reverberation algorithms and how they work, and it's not quite the same in real life. Early and late reflections serve different purposes. They're perceived differently. But do they look different? What's the difference between the generation mechanisms of early and late reflections? I'll talk a bit about that first. This illustration was ripped off the Sound on Sound website, and it shows here wonderful early reflections being quite ragged in nature and beautifully monotonic. And at this point in time, they stop all of a sudden and neatly, this lovely diffuse reverberation, which doesn't look particularly diffuse, but never mind, marches into the horizon, and it's very, very lovely. Look, you can see where the transition is because reverberation turns red at a certain point in time. Very handy. Now, from the point of view of illustration, I can see what he's driving at, and it's kind of how artificial reverb algorithms work, but he's taking a few poetic liberties. What I'm going to show you now is a few calculations from simulated rooms. They're not very tidy, are they? I don't know if you can see this axis, but it goes up to 200 milliseconds. There's two different rooms here with two different reverberation times. First thing you'll notice is that reverberation times don't look that different on paper because the density of reflections is pretty much determined by the inverse... The level of reflections, the stronger reflections, is pretty much determined by the inverse pressure law. So sound takes a mean free path and occasionally reflects off the most reflective objects in the room, and you get that. It's the density of reflections that dictate reverberation time as much as it is the individual reflections themselves. Also, they're quite chaotic, and this doesn't show half the picture either because it's generated by computer. What you don't see is all of the nasty scattering and diffusion you get because real things don't reflect sound in a specular mirror-like way. They shove it all over the place. What I'm going to do is play you what happens in a room. This is quite fun. I'll explain first what we're going to do. I processed these sounds based on the acoustics of reflective surfaces in a room, and everything is modelled about the room apart from diffusion. So what you're going to hear is a modelled room with all the surfaces correct, with most of the stereo spread correct, with the inverse pressure law correct, air absorption correct. So it's a fairly well simulated room. But by simulating room, what we can do is a bit of magic. We can slow the speed of sound down. You can hear individual reflections and how they build up, how they decay, and how they're filtered with time. Now, I wanted to use a familiar source. I put this slide together on the evening of May the 5th, I think. And at that time, the most familiar source to everybody in England was David Cameron saying the word change. So I've used that as processing material. I'll play you the unprocessed sound, put it in context first.
That's just unacceptable, and we need change to make that happen.
The word change?
Change.
I'm going to ride the fader because this gets quite quiet quite quickly. What we can do is the speed of sound is now about a metre and a half a second, so you'll be able to hear what happens as the reflections decay and as the density builds up in the room.
Change.
Interesting curiosity. The other room is largely similar, so I won't bother playing that. Actually, no, I will, because you'll see there's it's quite a bit more spiky than the other one. It's a much deader room.
Change.
So there's some emergent word use. You can hear the word change. Several seconds into this example, you can still hear it quite clearly. That would be a flutter echo in a normal room, which I haven't treated. So reverberation is messy, we conclude from that. There is no neat bimodal thing that you see in real life. You never experience it. Early-late reflection distinctions are perceived, they're not intrinsic. It's all about when they arrive, how quiet they are. A whole load of things happen in the human hearing system depending on when reflections arrive as to how we perceive them. So I'll move on to a very lovely diagram that's been compiled from a from a whole series of different papers about what happens when you hear a single reflection and how it affects the human hearing system's interpretation of it. This was anechoic classical music, just to put into perspective. If you listen to clicks or tones or speech, you get slightly different results because the amplitude profile is slightly different and some things are masked. But one thing they all agree on is very, very early on, within the first millisecond, you're still working out the interval time differences of a sound. You're waiting for the next wavefront to arrive. So if you start playing disruptive echoes very, very early on, you end up shifting the image, summing localization. So if the sound comes from a certain point to the left, you still hear the sound as you would otherwise, but the image moves wholly to the left. There's no broadening of the image. It's all perfectly integrated into what you're hearing as a scene. Beyond that, an echo suppression mechanism kicks in. This is hardwired into your neurons, really, this one. Until about 5 milliseconds, you get an image shift, but the effect is much less pronounced. It's a maximum of about 5 degrees away from where the sound is meant to be played. No matter what the level is, even if the level is greater than that of the original sound, there's an inhibitory mechanism there that prevents you from integrating that information. Beyond 5 milliseconds, and this is the horrible stuff, you get a tone coloration. You also get this impression of the sound broadening. Now, this is horrible because it's very, very difficult to model neurophysically. It's quite a high-level thing. It depends on the program material. It depends on how long you've been in the room that you're listening in, all kinds of things. If you want, you can will yourself to turn that mechanism off and you can listen analytically in a different way. It's a very high-level thing. It happens. It's under conscious control. And for that reason, people who try and model the human auditory system, as I did for about 4 years, absolutely hate it. It's a very useful thing because it means you can appreciate music when there's a reverberation time of a couple of seconds without it absolutely ruining the picture for you. But to model it is a real pain. So tone coloration comes in here, and so does a sense of spatial impression, a sense of a broadening of the image. It's one of the reasons why if you listen to a physically narrow instrument in a lovely concert hall, the image starts to fizz in front of you and it broadens. And while you can pinpoint where it is, there's almost a kind of aura around it. It's because of these reflections from the sidewalls decorrelating the sound slightly quite early on. Beyond 50 milliseconds, echo disturbance. You hear it as a discrete echo and it's annoying, and you do what you can to get rid of it if you're an acoustician. So what happens to a single reflection, let alone what happens to a complex pattern of reflection, depends very much on when they happen, how loud they are, what kind of tone colour they have. So early reflections aren't intrinsically different, they're just perceived in a different way to later decay. They colour the direct sound because they're essentially a comb filter. One signal arriving within a few milliseconds of another one, you get maximum or minimum depending on the frequency. It's a comb filter. The perceived location of they blur the perceived location of the source, producing a sensation of source width, without which there is no source width. It's the only way we hear width is by this decorrelation, these disturbing reflections. Even physically wide objects produce this decorrelation. The piano string vibrates at different frequencies, at different phases along its length, and the whole image gets blurred as a result. That's why pianos sound wide, because they are, because there's a big physical mass, soundboard and a string that's emitting sound at different phases. Actually, source width is desirable. We try and create it. There's a lot of literature from the 60s onwards when people moved beyond the Sabine formula and realized there's more to a concert hall than just getting the reverberation time right. There's an awful lot of literature about how to broaden the sound, how to encourage lateral reflections, which decorrelate the sound more than reflections from the ceiling, and how to get rid of ceiling reflections, and why the profile of early reflections is very, very important to the perceived quality of the image. So, and together with reverberation, of course, the pattern of early reflections and the level of them determine the room size. You can tell if you're in a big or a small room by the amount of comb filtering that's going on. Late reverberation, perceived very differently. This is reverberation after about 50 to 80 milliseconds, generally, depending on what you're listening to. After this consciously controllable echo suppression effect has subsided somewhat and you just hear reverb as reverb. It's a separate thing that you're aware of. Both the level of the reverb, of course, and the reverberation time determine the audibility. It's a two-dimensional problem. It's not just about reverb time, which a lot of recording engineers don't seem to appreciate. And a lot do, of course. Wider stereo produces a sense of envelopment, a sense of kind of being surrounded by the image, but it doesn't actually increase the width of the image at all. And the tone of the reverberation is controlled by source directivity, so if you've got a very directional source, what's coming out of the back of it tends to have very little high-frequency content, and what you hear in the room as a result is a lot muddier. It's journey through the air because air absorbs the top two octaves of sound quite effectively after a few metres, and reflections off walls and obstacles. Well, that's why it's reverb. Rooms and artificial reverb can have pathological effects like flutter echoes, which are a nightmare, and coupled spaces. I only mention this because if you're trying to simulate if you're trying to simulate an acoustic space for virtual reality purposes or computer gaming purposes, to do that is a completely different problem. You can't model coupled spaces using a conventional reverb model. You have to have two together, and you have to pan one, essentially, and it's quite a horrible thing to have to do. But a lot of rooms suffer from coupled spaces. I don't like this diagram, but I'm going to use it anyway because I can't think of a better way of representing this data. This is a kind of, I suppose it's a Venn diagram, really. So early reflections, this is a message. Early reflections and only early reflections are responsible for the perceptive source width. You can't play around with the late reverb and broaden the source, it just won't work. Late reverberation and only late reverberation is responsible for envelopment and the sense of being inside a place surrounded by sound. The wider the reverberation is, the more this sense of envelopment persists. Room size and the distance and perspective are controlled by both. The early reflections have to be there in order to get a sense of room size. The late reverb has to be there as well, because without it, you don't really get a feel for the ringiness of the room, the reverberation of the surfaces, and you don't really have enough information in enough time to determine how wide the room is. You can kind of guess, but it's a very unsatisfying simulation, and there's a bit of that in the audio file that I'll point to later. So that sums it up nicely. I think this is the end of this particular section. Yes, it is. Hooray. How am I doing for time? Yeah, that's good. I've got time left. Simulating loudspeakers. I'll talk about loudspeakers now because, as I've said, we know about loudspeakers. They're acoustically interesting and complicated objects. They radiate sound in a very particular way. String instruments radiate sound in a particular other way. Brass instruments are similar to loudspeakers in some ways and different in others, but we'll talk about loudspeakers, about how they affect the direct and reverberant sound. I have here the frequency response of a small loudspeaker. This is one that's in the Focusrite office, in fact. It sits on somebody's desk banging out techno music most of the time, which is probably why the high frequency end is rather knackered. But I did equalize it with a shelving filter to make it flat when I did some measurements. So there is a frequency response on axis, fairly nice and flat. If we smooth it a bit, we might have it ready for a data sheet. 30 degrees off axis, 60, 90 degrees off axis, it's a bloody mess. And this is why most loudspeaker manufacturers won't publish directional data unless they're reputable, unless they're designed for professionals who know what they're doing. People don't want to see things that look like that, so they generally suppress that data, but they do measure it. A lot of John Vanderkoy's papers about what B&W does, Bowers and Wilkins, are about trying to get the directional measurements right and optimizing the directional response of loudspeakers because it's very important. I'll come to that now. Why can't a loudspeaker like that reproduce a voice convincingly? And when I'm talking to smaller audiences, I bring the loudspeaker with me and I play my voice through it, and I've equalized it to sound flat, and obviously the two things sound completely different despite the fact it's got a completely flat frequency response. Once I've equalised it. Why can't it reproduce a voice convincingly? Directivity of the drive units, of course. It's a slightly different size to the human head, so it radiates sound differently. The directional properties are different. So the reverb is all wrong. Soft dome tweeters are particularly bad at doing this if they're not engineered properly. Soft dome tweeters are designed to beam in a controlled way so that at higher frequencies, it becomes more and more directional. It doesn't shoot sound out the sides in an uncontrolled way, but it does become extraordinarily directional. So if you look at the 12 kilohertz thing, 12 kilohertz and 16 kilohertz, and even the 8 kilohertz things I've measured here from the loudspeaker, 30 dB down at 180 degrees, there's very little going on in the top three octaves in terms of sound being radiated behind the cabinet. You're not exciting the reverberant field in the same way that you're exciting the direct sound. Soft dome tweeters are a particular culprit of this because they're designed to decay in that way rather than just beaming sound out in every direction like a porcupine. Speech is a very critical test signal. You can hear very small impairments in it, so it's a bit cruel to play speech through a loudspeaker. Bass porting, which this loudspeaker is, really messes up the time domain response. What it does is it gives you an extra octave of response. So, oh, I've got a tiny box and it's flat down to 80 or 70 hertz, but it's only got a 4-inch woofer. If you don't have a bass port there, it's only flat down to about 160 hertz. And what you don't get is the tuned woof that you get when you have a bass port. You can hit the woofer and it sounds like a conga drum now. It responds to every impulse in the same way. So if you're playing an impulsive sound through it, you will get this ringing wrist resonance. And if you play a sign through it, it looks lovely. If you play a real sound through it, it sounds horrible. Now, there are well-designed ports, which are basically extraordinarily damped, and there are badly designed ports, which basically try and get the frequency down as far as possible for the sake of the data sheet and sound bloody awful. This happens to be one of the latter. So it was an interesting exercise, but I'm not going to repeat it today because the room is too small and I don't want to schlep a loudspeaker through the tube. Loudspeaker directivity. Here's an example. It's a Yamaha NS10M. For the sake of political equality, I actually had Nick Clegg saying the word change.
Together we really will change through.
Now, he says the word together. There's an unintended irony there, which I love. He had no idea, of course, at the time that he'd end up getting into bed with the Tories. So, unprocessed.
Together we really will change through.
Front of an NS10M.
Together we really will change through.
It's a truly nasty speaker, isn't it? The back of it.
Together we really will change through.
And 45 degrees.
Together we really will change through.
We know they're dreadful. Snobbery aside, they sell for £750 a pair on eBay still, and nobody knows why. It's probably because they're not ported. It's the only thing people like about them. Loudspeakers and reverberation. The recording studio is reverberant? Yes. The listening room is reverberant? Yes. So we're putting reverb in series with reverb whenever we listen through a loudspeaker in a room. What happens? This is interesting, of course, because this is how we listen, and it changes the spatial cues. The effect on early reflections, because you're increasing the density of early reflections, it feels like listening in a smaller room. If you remember, if you're getting more and more reflections, it's as if the walls are closer to you. If you're increasing the level, it's again as if the walls are closer to you. So you're listening in a smaller room virtually than either the recording studio or the listening room. It shrinks the size of the room having reflections there. Of course, we need them in order to put sound into perspective, but this is what happens. You need to be aware of it. Recorded reflections all come from the front. So you lose source width, you lose envelopment, because the correlation between the ears is higher. All of the sound is frontal. There's nothing behind you, so when you move your head, you can immediately tell that the sound's in front of you. There's nothing at your left and your right ear, so you're not getting the same kind of effects you get from real room reverberation. You lose source width, you lose envelopment. There's nothing you can do about it. Distance cues are largely unaffected by this because they're influenced quite heavily by the late reverberant tail, which we'll come to in a minute. And it reduces the intelligibility, as you know, if you're listening in a dreadful listening room. Frequency spectrum is coloured by the loudspeakers as well as the original instruments. It'll all sound boomy. The reason I'm going to refer now to Phil Spector's Wall of Sound is that it was a common practice of Phil Spector, because he worked in mono and because the equipment of the day was so limited and because he liked the effect it gave, to bounce recordings down in a recording studio by playing them through a loudspeaker and picking them up with a mono mic. You can't equalise out the effect of the loudspeaker or the effect of the room. If you try and make it brighter because the loudspeaker's directivity is all cockeyed at the back, you'll end up making the original sound too bright. Human hearing system isn't really fooled by hearing, by doing that kind of equalization, because it messes up the, it preserves the disparity between the direct sound and the reverb. So either you make the reverb sound all dull and horrible, or you make the direct sound too bright. There's not much you can do about it, which is why a lot of his early recordings do sound fairly boomy. It's almost as if the backing track is being played through a sock. Now, that's not being disparaging about Phil Spector, because he was a genius, clearly, and he did set us on the path of albums for album's sake. And I suppose for that reason he's to blame for the Sugar Babes, but we won't go into that. Why is it now a badge of pride for bands to be able to play their own instruments? I don't understand. I'm getting old. Perceived distance will generally... Sorry? Okay, everything is relative. Perceived distance will generally be reduced by the by this. I've just contradicted myself, haven't I? I'll come back to that later. But because of the coloration, the reverberation content is reduced at low high frequencies, which means you don't have as much of that. So it's actually the directivity is reducing the perceived direction, perceived distance. I'm losing it now. I'm going to have some more water. Talk amongst yourselves if you want to. Excellent. The effect on late decay, well, that's very simple because it's diffuse, it's broad, it's just really decaying noise. The loudest tail dominates, everything else is masked, so the most reverberant room wins, which generally speaking is a recording studio, so that's great. Late reverberation is generally fine. The future of headphone listening, and that's why this lecture is interesting. The why this is interesting stuff, I hope, is slightly implicit within the lecture itself, but I'm going to talk now about why it's really interesting. Headphones are cheaper and more linear than the best loudspeakers. You can go out to whichever your favourite hi-fi or recording shop is, and you can spend £100, and you can buy a really, really good, really linear set of headphones that sound great, or you can buy a really crappy set of loudspeakers. It's much, much easier to get good headphones than just to get a good loudspeaker, so there's an appeal there from a cost point of view. No listening room acoustics are imposed. You can control exactly what happens at the left and the right ear. No crosstalk between the two channels. Using DSP, we can simulate any sound field accurately. Having a realistic sound field, of course, as long as you're doing it properly and you're not throwing cues into conflict and you're not making the illusion inconsistent, can reduce listening fatigue. You can listen for a lot longer without getting upset by what you're hearing. When you get to that point where the EQ knob doesn't seem to do anything anymore, or when you start getting annoyed by having to continue listening. It doesn't matter whether headphones are open or closed, as long as they're sufficiently linear, the solution persists and it works quite well. We proved this at Focusrite fairly informally, but we went through a whole load of different tests with headphones, and as long as the headphones are of reasonable quality, actually the way that they're designed doesn't seem to have much bearing on the quality of the simulation. We're generally restricted to static listening positions at the moment because head tracking is expensive. For full 3D immersion, though, we will need it. But this is where it gets interesting, because real hard-time head tracking in DSP is becoming cost-effective. Within the next 2 or 3 years, we'll be able to put it in consumer products, and it will cost £100 rather than a couple of £1,000. Greater processing power will allow us to have dynamically adaptable acoustics, so we'll be able to change the room mid-flow. We'll be able to have the reflections themselves adjusting. If somebody opens or closes a virtual door. True 3D positioning of multiple moving sources. Now, the applications of this, I probably don't even have to mention. Improved virtual reference monitoring. Now, this is where, for example, you have a suboptimal listening room. Either you're living in a pokey flat in London with paper-thin walls and your neighbour starts throwing bricks at your window if you go on mixing past 11 at night. Or you're in a very, very old building which has beautiful acoustics, but because of the way it's designed, your live room and your recording room have to be the same, which means you have to listen on headphones. Or for a number of different reasons, where you've got a suboptimal listening environment, having head-tracked virtual reality listening to stereo sound is actually quite a neat idea, as long as you get it right. Computer games. The computer game market is trivial, it's frivolous, I know, but it's huge! It's now bigger than films. There's a lot of money to be made out of it. There's lots of symposia about computer games audio. There's lots of people working in that field. There are computer games music courses at university now. There's quite an art to it. It's really quite an interesting thing to do. But if people are willing to spend £150 on a Poncy graphics card, perhaps they'll be willing to spend £100 on a Poncy sound card. Computer gaming is also largely a solitary activity. Forget the Nintendo Wii. That's just a gimmick. Most computer gaming happens people alone in their rooms late at night, playing Tomb Raider for some reason. And having headphones on is a natural paradigm already, so we might as well do something with this, make the experience more immersive. Defense. Defense is another interesting use. There's a researcher in Canada who works in a very similar remit to mine, a lot more experienced, however, called Durand Bigault. He worked at NASA. One of the things that he was doing in the late 80s and early 90s was putting this kind of technology into cockpit helmets for pilots, so that while they were flying, formation flying or in an attack situation, the cues from the warning bleeps from instruments would appear where the instruments were in the cockpit, sounds of missiles firing or planes or people talking to them. The air traffic control would appear from below them and different planes would appear around them. And from a survival point of view, that's what you expect. And if you keep the image realistic, you can act through it much more quickly. If you can react much more quickly, you're more likely to survive, because 50 milliseconds can make the difference between being blown up and not being blown up on a fighter plane. So he was looking into that. And of course, the great thing about defence is money doesn't seem to be much of an object. Spending £100,000 on the pilot's helmet seems to be quite a reasonable thing to do. It's just crazy money. Governments love spending on defence. It makes them look big. Not yet. In fact, it's the only difference. It's the only punchline to war. What is it good for, isn't it? The aerospace industry, basically. War is great for aerospace. And it's not yet suitable for portable applications because the processing power is high and it drains batteries in seconds. There are ways of optimising it so that it's a bit more friendly for portable applications. There's another chap called Jerome Brebar who's looking into this and using very, very simplified head-related transfer functions and not doing too much convolution in order to try and get the processing load down. And he thinks he's come up with a system that seems quite convincing. It's a static, it's not a head-tracked system, but it can produce a pretty convincing fake loudspeaker stereo image with room reverberation on a fairly modest portable device without draining the battery too much. So there are ways of doing it. What it takes is for processing power to become less expensive in terms of watts, and basically for chip voltages to fall. And it also takes us to be a bit more clever in working out what we really need to put into a simulation and what we don't. Headphones can't replace loudspeakers. I'm not a headphone evangelist. Loudspeaker was invented about 110 years ago, and it'll still be around in 110 years' time because it does stuff that headphones can't. You can address a large crowd of people with it. You can stick one in a museum and have it blaring out informative information. You can have them at train stations. To reach a large audience and to do certain things, you can't replace loudspeakers, and I wouldn't even try to. So this is just my way of saying I'm not a headphone evangelist. I don't think that in 50 years' time no one will have loudspeakers anymore and everyone will be walking around with headphones permanently attached to their ears. Well, that does seem to be the way the world is going. Conclusion, conveying space in recordings now. This was the one that was really aimed at the recording engineers in the audience. Now, I'm not a recording engineer. The reason I'm here today is because I was much better at differential calculus than I was at pushing faders. I became a kind of rent-a-geek for Focusrite, a kind of audio boffin, because I wasn't really very good at a mix engineer, didn't have the patience. But there aren't very many people around who believe that just because you come from an academic background, you have nothing to contribute. There are a few of them, and they sometimes get interviewed in Resolution magazine about a couple of months ago. But it's a bit sad if you... Academics, as well as practitioners, have a lot to contribute to sound recording. We invent all the stuff, for example. And one thing that I'd like to say, I don't know if this works or not, I've not tried it, but from a theoretical point of view, it does seem to be right. You can't add space to recording by turning up the reverb. That's a fact. You can go and demonstrate it yourself if you want to. You can't make a recording, make a sound source seem wide and make things seem to fizz around you. You can't add any kind of excitement to a mono source by turning up the reverb unless you're adjusting the early reflections. The sense of being in a certain space depends entirely on early reflections. The sense of width depends entirely on early reflections. If you record acoustic instruments in stereo, you capture the early reflections from the original room, so you're already starting with a correlated source. And now we're living in the 21st century when channels are cheap and you can have 200 of them because the hard disk's fast enough. It's great. So there's absolutely no excuse not to try spot miking in stereo to every single source you record. And if you do that, the natural mechanisms in the human hearing system that get rid of the comb filtering because you've got one signal in one ear and another signal in another and it can kind of compute out all the nasty comb stuff that you get from reflections, they can all operate. So you end up with being able to pull the microphones back to capture more reverb because the human auditory system can cope with that. If you try doing it with a mono microphone, you just end up with a muddy coloured sound. If you try doing it in stereo, that happens, but only much, much later. So you capture more ambience if you record in stereo. Duh. Choose loudspeakers to avoid listening fatigue. Now, this was aimed at the students, but there are some interesting points there. Ignore manufacturers' frequency response data because it tells you one dimension of a multi-dimensional puzzle. Some of the best microphones in the world don't really do anything below 120 hertz. The LF35A, for example, is a marvellous loudspeaker, and it doesn't do much below 120 hertz. But the reason it's great is because it's well-designed. It's good at what it does. don't really have to generally play a lot of bass music through it, and even if you do, everything but the bottom string of a six-string bass is pretty much reproducible. So the very, very low end can largely be ignored because people achieve it either by using speakers that are so large that a diffraction around them makes them completely unrepresentative of the original sound sources, or they're so ported that they just can't reproduce anything impulsive without sounding ghastly. So to some extent, there are some better designs out there now which use many cabinets and to avoid this kind of diffraction effect, and that's why they... A lot of the new expensive loudspeakers tend to have the tweeters and a little pod all of their very own. But ignore manufacturers' frequency response data to some extent because it only tells a tiny part of the story, and that's the bit they try to optimize at the expense of everything else. Audition new loudspeakers by doing a complete mix down on them because that's the way to test for listening fatigue. Avoid over-treating the back wall of the mixing studio. Give your ear-brain mechanism something to work with. Otherwise, everything comes from the front, and when you move your head, everything's frontal and it feels quite oppressive. If you're going to treat a wall, treat the front wall, because that's where all the sound's already coming from. It gives you much better balance. And don't monitor on PA speakers for extended periods. They're designed for a different purpose. They're designed to be extraordinarily directional so that you don't get any... so that it cuts down the amount of reflections you get in a venue, which generally has quite high reverberation time and a low ceiling, and is generally not designed to reproduce sound. If you try mixing on it in a room, you won't have enough reflections in the room. The diffuse field energy of the loudspeaker is... It's pretty omnidirectional at low frequencies, and high frequencies are just nothing there at all. They're absolutely ghastly for critical listening. They're a recipe for listening fatigue. Now, the reason you don't get a listening fatigue at a concert, of course, is because what's missing from your ears is filled in by your eyes. You can see people playing instruments, you can see them moving about the stage, and for that reason, because visual senses are so strong, it's completely convincing. You don't get listening fatigue at a gig unless a sound engineer's playing it through a telephone or something like that. So don't monitor on PA speakers, so you're just asking for making yourself angry. Time delay panning is less stable than amplitude panning. Now, this argument's been going on for as long as people have been recording two channels. But the advice from academics is always to avoid it, except as a creative tool. And to avoid space microphone pairs, but only, you only need to do this when precise imaging is important. Because the imaging isn't precise from a stereo pair. It's not a linear representation of what you're listening to in the same way the coincident pair is. Things tend to swim around. It tends to broaden sound a lot because of all the phase differences between the loudspeakers. It's not very stable. It's not mono-compatible. But if you're recording an orchestra where the first violins are about 10 feet wide, it doesn't really matter exactly where precise positioning is, which is why the Decca tree works so well as a recording technique if you're recording an orchestra. But if you're doing a string quartet, precise positioning is important. You want a more stable image, so coincident pairs are the way to go. Level differences only, not time differences. So there are caveats academics sometimes forget to put in, and that's possibly why they lose some respect. I can talk about myself. We lose some respect. Oversimplifying the picture is always a bad thing to do. Overcompression destroys spatial detail. Now, this has nothing to do with the loudness walls, but too high a ratio will destroy the shape of the reverberation and will ruin the perspective. So you'll end up boosting the reverberant tail, increasing effectively the RT60, making the spatial cues inconsistent because the early reflections are still the same. Too high release time will mess up early reflections. You'll feel like you're in a different room. Everything will get messed up. Things will close in. The room will appear smaller. And generally, doesn't work quite so well. This is something else I haven't tried because I don't generally have access to unmixed recordings. But if you are going to compress stuff heavily, try adding reverb later, because then at least it's consistent. It'll probably have to have a different profile. Well, undoubtedly have to have a different profile because you're adding it later. But it should sound... You're not corrupting a spatial image, and things will sound a lot less oppressive as a result. I think that's all I've got to say. Thank you very much.
Do you have time for some questions?
I have time if you have time. It wasn't deliberate.
Anybody any questions?
Oh, yes.
Hello, Mr. Waldron.
Hi, sir. It's so fascinating, but you have dinner with me tonight. So I've already carry on talking to you about all this. Hey!
Yes, you may.
So that's a request for a date. Does anybody have any other questions?
Which quads are they? Are they ESL 63s?
No, the early ones.
59s?
Yes.
Ooh, very nice. You lucky man. Well, they're effectively a dipole, aren't they? So you're pumping quite a lot of high-frequency stuff all around the room.
Right.
Why do the low frequencies sound so good? Well, it's probably down to the near-field effects you get, because it's quite a large source moving. And the source effectively shrinks.
My boys then might be... It's not enough for the modern
rock. Oh, they'll learn.
Yeah, well, I hope they do. But it still sounds accurate, even so.
They're just well-designed loudspeakers. Also, the physical source shrinks as the high energy content increases, and so they do all the right things generally. They knew what they were doing. And they're also dipoles, so they radiate sound properly in all directions, and they're fairly uniform. Which means, of course, that the reverb you're listening to is consistent with the reverb you recorded. It's got the room imposed on it, but you're not adding any kind of extra low-frequency woofiness. Keeping a tone colour right is quite important. If you've ever heard omnidirectional or dipole loudspeakers, they sound lovely for that reason. Or at least I believe they do. It's a matter of opinion.
You said B&W speakers are particularly nice for
I don't know if they are. I just know that the person who they got in as a technical consultant, John Van Der Kooi, really does know what he's talking about. I don't own a pair of B&W speakers, and I haven't measured any. So I know they've got good research going on there. So I wouldn't like to comment on the quality of their current output.
Right, I was just wondering if they have quite large tweeters compared to other speakers I've used. So I'm just wondering if that's something...
Are they moving coil tweeters, or are they dome?
Dome.
That might be why, then. Again, it's high-frequency radiation patterns. One thing about B&Ws is traditionally their hi-fi speakers have very shallow crossovers. And if you try and measure them on axis, they look awful, but actually sound all right because you're putting the same power into the room anyway. But British hi-fi speakers in general tend to have very shallow crossovers.
Any more questions? Hello, Ben. You had a slide about soft dome tweeters and the directivity of them. But was it? Did you allude that it was also the transient response of a fabric dome tweeter that was maybe smeared that affected? I forgot what you said. What was affected?
The physics of small moving coil and large moving coil loudspeakers are the same. In the same way that the physics of a cannon and a pistol are the same, they sound different because they're different sizes. So if you can do a decent tweeter, if you can do a decent woofer, you can do a decent tweeter with the same moving coil architecture. I wouldn't like to comment on the transient response of soft dome tweeters, but because I've never measured one on its own, but I'm sure they're okay. There we are. That was the one. There's not much written on the slide. I did most of it came out of my mouth. But the reason that soft dome tweeters should be used with great caution is because of the directivity response rather than the impulse response. You can always equalise an impulse response until it's about right, especially with an active speaker. Impulse responses, unless you're really messing up long-term time domain stuff, don't generally matter too much because you can process them.
Okay, thank you.
It's all right.
I have one more. How can we educate young producers to understand stereo again?
You've used the E word. When I went for my interview at Focusrite, actually, being quite a marketing and sales-driven company, one of the pieces of advice I was given is if any manufacturer you're working for starts to talk about educating the market, you're onto a loser and get out. Because you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make it think. And we're up against quite a lot. We're up against the hi-fi press writing reams and reams of crap. And we're up against the people in recording studios and mastering studios producing stuff with no dynamic range. That basically looks like a rectangle. It's a kind of spread spectrum frequency response. And with that, I think people who are really into music, who love music, who are educated in music, will eventually find that path on their own. They'll eventually look for something more satisfying, and they'll meet the right person who will induct them into the wonderful world of loudspeakers, and they'll be prepared to listen. But in terms of educating the mass market, I really don't think you can. I think you're onto a loser, which is why well-designed loudspeakers tend to be expensive and produced in small numbers. That's just my opinion, but I know it's shared by...
I'm afraid you're right, yeah.
...people at Focusrite, at least. That doesn't mean to say that we don't design lovely products. We do, but we are aware of this.
Any more questions? Okay, well, thank you very much, Ben. Thank you once again.